Good morning and welcome. My name is Elaine Holden, and it is my pleasure to welcome you to the Monadnock Summer Lyceum with today's guest speaker, Dr. Kate Larson. Today's talk may be heard on NPR two Sundays from now at 10 p.m. The talk will also be available on our website, monadnocklyceum.org. After the presentation, in keeping with the Lyceum tradition, Dr. Larson has agreed to answer questions from the audience. The Monadnock Summer Lyceum is supported entirely through contributions from our audience members, and we do deeply appreciate your donations, which may be placed in the glass bowls in the church and in the parish hall. We thank you for your generous support. Our speaker today is Dr. Kate Clifford Larson. Dr. Larson, an historian and celebrated author, has a long and very distinguished reputation of chronicling the histories of notable women in America. She has written three critically acclaimed biographies, Bound for the Promised Land, Harriet Tubman, Portrait of an American Hero, The Assassin's Accomplice, Mary Surratt and the Plot to Kill Abraham Lincoln, and the topic of her talk this morning, Rosemary, the Hidden Kennedy Daughter. Dr. Larson has served as a consultant and interpretive specialist for numerous museum and public history initiatives that have focused on the lives and contributions of women in the making of our national identity. For example, Dr. Larson wrote one of the first non-juvenile biographies of Harriet Tubman that has been published in six decades. This important work has earned her recognition from institutions around the country, including the Wilbur H. Seabird Award from the National Park Service, Network to Freedom Program, for outstanding research on Harriet Tubman, her community, and the Underground Railroad. She also received a commendation from the South Carolina House of Representatives for her significant work on the life of Harriet Tubman, and an Educational Excellence Award from the Maryland Historical Trust for her work on the program, They're Finding a Way to Freedom, Harriet Tubman Underground Railroad Tour. Dr. Larson holds a legacy fellowship from the American Antiquarian Society in Worcester, Massachusetts, a Price Research Fellowship from the William L. Clements Library at the University of Michigan, and a fellowship from the John Nichols Brown Center for the Study of American Civilization at Brown University. Dr. Larson earned two degrees from Simmons College, as well as an MBA from Northeastern University and a PhD from the University of New Hampshire. Dr. Larson has held a Margaret Storrs Grierson Scholarship and Residence Fellowship from the Sophia Smith Collection at Smith College, Northampton, Massachusetts, as well as a Mary Catherine Mooney Fellowship at the Boston Athenaeum. And just this May, the University of New Hampshire awarded Dr. Larson an honorary doctorate for her work in women's history. We are indeed very fortunate to have such a remarkable woman as our speaker this morning, and I would ask you to please join me now in extending a warm Monadnock Summer Lyceum welcome to Dr. Kate Larson.
Thank you, Elaine. Well, thank you all for coming and welcoming here to me here to the Monadnock region. This is a beautiful, beautiful building, and I feel honored to come here and speak about my work, particularly on Rosemary Kennedy. Today I'm going to tell you a little bit about myself, how I came to write about Rosemary Kennedy, and I hope that you walk away with a better understanding of this hidden daughter in the Kennedy family. So back in 2005, I was working on my Mary Surratt book, and it was in January, and I read Rosemary Kennedy's obituary in the Boston Globe. And it was about three paragraphs long, and like many New Englanders, I was aware of the Kennedy family. I had actually read some of those biographies of the family, Doris Kern Goodwin's book and others. And Rosemary was always this sort of footnote when reading about and learning about the family. So when I read this three-paragraph obituary and description of Rosemary, it just, I don't know, there was something about it that hit me. and I wanted to know more about her. And of course, you know, it mentioned the tragedy of her life, but I just knew that there was something missing and there was possibly something there to be learned. But I was busy with my Mary Surratt book, so I had to put it aside. In 2008, I was done with Mary Surratt, who, by the way, was a very wicked woman. For those of you who think she might have been innocent, no, she was guilty. So I was ready to take on another project. And fortunately, I live right outside of Boston, and the Kennedy Library is right there in Boston. And they had just recently started to release Rose Kennedy's papers to the public for viewing. So I went to the library, and there were newly opened scrapbooks that Rose had kept from her young teenagehood through her marriage and raising her family. And there were lots of letters and interesting things in that collection. And at the same time, the library had started to open Joe Kennedy's papers as well. And to understand the dynamic of this presidential library, which is a magnificent library for anybody who hasn't been there, I encourage you to go. It's beautiful. And now the Ted Kennedy Center is right there next door to it. It's a great visit. Anyway, the family owns the collections of papers housed at the library that are not connected to Jack Kennedy. The presidential papers are public property, they are open to the public, but the family papers, the family has control over what is made available. In their deed of gift to the library, there was a timetable set up where they had agreed over a period of like 30 years, certain portions of these collections could be opened. When I started in 2008, they were slowly opening these collections, and by the time I finished researching and writing the book in late 2014, a lot of the collections had been opened. And what I was able to see is more information about Rosemary that other historians did not have access to or didn't bother to really use in their biographies of the Kennedy family. And there were letters written by Rosemary, starting when she was a young child through her adult years. And it gave me a glimpse into Rosemary's life, and it gave voice to Rosemary versus what everyone else was saying about Rosemary. So this is what I learned about Rosemary, the third child of Joe and Rose Kennedy. She was born in September of 1918, and at that time, in that month of September, the Spanish influenza was sweeping through Boston on its second sweep across the globe. And it had already killed millions and millions of people. And it was killing and debilitating thousands and thousands of Bostonians. So Rose goes into labor in the midst of this kind of epidemic. And her obstetrician was at a local hospital treating the patients of this flu, and she was home with an obstetrical nurse. And the protocol was that the nurse was there to keep Rose comfortable until the doctor could arrive to deliver the child in their home. But the doctor was delayed, and even though the nurse had been trained how to deliver a baby, her priority was to wait for the doctor. So Rose, now giving birth to her third child, she had two little boys, Joe and Jack, and the labor was coming on fast and furious. So the nurse asked Rose to cross her legs and hold the baby back, not to push the baby out. And of course, Rose couldn't do that. So the nurse held baby Rosemary back in the birth canal until the doctor could arrive. So it is my belief that that moment deprived Rosemary of needed oxygen and led to her intellectual disabilities that would emerge fairly soon when she was an infant and small child, a toddler. Rose, of course, was thrilled to have a baby girl. She had grown up with sisters whom she loved deeply, and it was a great joy to both she and Joe to have this quiet, peaceful little girl as they had these two rambunctious boys running around the house. And Rosemary was an easy baby. She was very quiet. She didn't cry much, according to Rose. She wasn't fussy, and Rose just thought she was blessed. just completely blessed with this little family and this perfect little girl. But they began to notice that Rosemary did not reach those milestones that infants and toddlers reach as they grow by the month. She didn't sit up early like the two boys did. It was very late learning to crawl and to walk and to talk, to feed herself. And Rose kept telling herself that it was probably because she was a little girl, and little girls are different than boys. Boys are, you know, rough and ready to go and do things quickly. But then Rose had more children. Kathleen came a year and then a few months later, and then Eunice, and more children. And comparing Rosemary to these other children, they began to realize that Rosemary did indeed have some disabilities. But being the Kennedys, they did not really want to accept the fact that there was something wrong. They sent Rosemary to kindergarten to the Edward Devotion School in Brookline, Massachusetts, where her two brothers had gone to school. And the teachers knew immediately that Rosemary was delayed. And they kept her back in kindergarten at least once, if not twice. But Rose and Joe hired tutors to help Rosemary and to work with her. And Rosemary also was very uncoordinated, so they had extra teachers teach her dancing. And when she would go sledding with her siblings and friends, she didn't know how to steer her sled on a slope. The Kennedys, of course, they're famous for their sailing skills. When they went sailing, Rosemary could not figure out how to sail the boat. It was very difficult for her to follow dance steps, you know, simple little things, but they kept training her and working with her, but she could never catch up to all these siblings who continued to, you know, Rose and Joe had nine children, and it was a very competitive family, very active, and Rosemary, the older she got, the less she could compete, and she could not keep up with her siblings. So it was a difficult childhood, happy, but it was difficult. The Kennedys ended up moving out of Boston and to New York. Joe felt that the opportunities would be much better for him and his children in New York. He was very resentful about the old Yankee guard and elite in New England. He felt they were keeping him down and they were not allowing him to join their clubs. So he felt that New York would provide better opportunities, which it did. And in the meantime, Joe became extremely successful. Many of you already know that he was a brilliant financier, and he was just a very smart businessman. I won't get into the details about his bootlegging and all that, but he was a very smart businessman. So they moved to New York, and they put Rosemary in the local public school in Riverdale along with her two sisters. She's in the same grade as first Kick and then Eunice because she keeps getting held back. And Rosemary, by the time she's 9, 10, 11 years old, she's acting out a lot. And you can imagine this child who has disabilities, who's being pushed and pushed by her parents, and not being able to compete and do things that her siblings can do, and then to be in the same classroom as her younger sisters. It was really frustrating for her. So Joe and Rose decided, when Rosemary was 11 years old, to send her away to boarding school. And for anyone who has raised a disabled child or worked with disabled children, know that oftentimes they are also emotionally immature and transitions are incredibly difficult. So they pack Rosemary up, 11 years old, and they send her off to the Devereux School outside of Philadelphia. Helen Devereux was a pioneer in educational techniques to help teach children with intellectual disabilities. And she had done wonders with creating programs in the Philadelphia school system, but she was frustrated with limitations that she was experiencing, so she opened her own school. And so Joe and Rose sent Rosemary there. Now, Ms. Devereux had some great ideas on training and teaching young children with disabilities, but she also was a little bit insensitive. The children were required to behave and do well in school, and if they did not, they could not go home for Thanksgiving. So here's little Rosemary, 11 years old, taken away from her family, her little cocoon where she felt safe with her siblings, and she's in this boarding school. She's not doing well in school. And in fact, it's heartbreaking because these letters are at the Kennedy Library, and she writes to her parents, "Dear Mother and Daddy, I'm doing so well in school. I'm getting 100 in arithmetic and 100 in English and 100 in history, and I'm behaving and I'm doing so well. You know, see, I'm being really good. I could come home." In the meantime, Mrs. Devereaux and the teachers are writing to Joe and Rose and telling them that Rosemary is acting out and she's not doing well in school at all. And Rosemary, as she gets closer to Thanksgiving, she's writing letters saying, "Have you asked Mrs. Devereaux if I can come home for Thanksgiving? Oh, please, I miss you. I love you. Please, can I come home for Thanksgiving?" It is heartbreaking to read these letters. She doesn't know that her parents know she's lying. In fact, Joe had sent a telegram to Rose, who had this habit of going off on 2 and 3 month vacations and leaving the children behind with the governesses and nurses. And she was in Europe in the fall of when Rosemary was sent to school the first time. And he sent a telegram to Rose and said, "Well, Rosemary was raising Cain, but now she seems to be calming down." So they were fully aware of how difficult a transition it was for Rosemary. But they didn't change their course. They kept Rosemary at that school for 2 years. But the Kennedys were determined to cure Rosemary. And in their letters, you can see this, they use that phrase over and over again. They send Rosemary to many different doctors who claim they too can cure Rosemary. They actually sent her to one doctor in Boston. He was a famous endocrinologist, did pioneering work, but he was convinced, and he convinced the Kennedys, that if he gave teenage Rosemary at this time hormone shots 3 days a week, that in 9 months she would be 100% cured. So this young girl had to endure shots of hormones, and heavens knows what those hormones were on a teenage girl. And of course it didn't cure her. She had intellectual disabilities. There was no cure. And they sent her to many other doctors who tried different techniques and different medical plans and treatment plans for her. And of course nothing worked. As she grew older, Rose and Joe sent her to 5 different private schools. A couple of them were Catholic schools and some of them were other private academies. And as Rosemary was shifted from one school to the next, she would become more and more destabilized. The transitions were incredibly difficult for her. And Joe and Rose just seemed to ignore that their daughter needed stability and she needed support at home, not being sent away to New York or Boston or wherever the schools were. As she grew older, her mental health began to deteriorate. She was lashing out, hitting people. It became a concern for the teachers and administrators at these schools that she was sent to. Rose and Joe were so duplicitous that when they enrolled her in a new school, they oftentimes did not tell the teachers and administrators that Rosemary was intellectually disabled and that she had these emotional outbursts. So it would be up to the teachers and the administrators to figure it out. And oftentimes they'd figure it out in a couple of weeks that something wasn't quite right. So Rose and Joe just really wanted Rosemary away. They did not want to deal with her. And it's a great tragedy. Her life was very lonely. She missed her family tremendously. She did learn, though. She did become educated, I think. She probably could read and write at a 3rd to 4th grade level. She learned a little French, but she loved to be social and she loved pretty clothes. And her letters are often about that, going to parties with girlfriends and all the dresses and having her eyebrows plucked and her nails done. You know, typical teenage girl chatter in her letters. So that gave me another side of Rosemary to understand and to kind of feel for. I began to really see her as a real person. So she was a delightful child, except for these outbursts and difficult times that she had. In 1938, her father, who had been quite successful during the Great Depression, he was still one of the wealthiest men in the country. He was extremely successful as the nation's first Securities Exchange Commission director, and he made a boatload of money. And he had done a lot of campaigning for FDR, who appointed him to the ambassadorship of Great Britain. So in 1938, the family is packed up and they move to London. And Rose is thrilled. She is such a political being. She grew up in her father's household, the famous mayor of Boston, Honey Fitz. And she just loved the possibility and the promise of being on a world stage and hosting events at the ambassador's residence, and her husband would be famous, and the family was already very famous in the United States, and once they went to England, they became famous around the world, and the press followed them everywhere, taking pictures of them, interviewing them. So at 20 years old, Rosemary was thrust into the limelight. She had been protected away at these private schools all that time, and very few people knew her, and very few people knew that she had disabilities. So they had to be very, very careful with her in public. They orchestrated every sort of public appearance that she was part of. Her father would hold on to her with a vice grip. And in fact, in my book, I have a couple of pictures of him. These were press photographs, and he's holding her arm so awkwardly, and you can tell he's holding on to her very tightly, not casually where she could loop her arm into her father's elbow. It was this grip that he had on her. So you could see the tension that they had when they took her out in public. The first 2 weeks that they arrived in London, they prepared Rosemary to be presented to the King and Queen of England. The spring is the high society season in London, where all the eligible young women and men of high society go through all these cotillions and balls, and they are presented to the King and Queen. So Rose and Joe decided that Rosemary and her younger sister, Kick, Kathleen, would be presented to the King and Queen. Rose ordered magnificent designer gowns for them, and they had to train Rosemary for 2 weeks on how to do the special curtsy that the young women were required to do in front of the King and Queen. Now, Kick could get that down in a couple of hours, but they needed the 2 weeks for Rosemary. They held their breath. She's presented to the King and Queen. She begins to stumble, but she catches herself, and it's a success. The interesting thing is, all the press was there, and they wrote stories about Kick and Rosemary, but particularly Rosemary. Rosemary was incredibly beautiful, by far the most beautiful of the Kennedy girls, and the press really loved her. And she had been trained not to talk much in public, so she seemed sort of mysterious and coy, so the press loved that even more so. And the articles that they wrote about the presentation, they talked about Rosemary's dress, not Kick's dress. And Rose was furious because she thought that Kick should get all of the attention and not Rosemary. Anyway, the children were all enrolled in school, and Rosemary was sent to an Assumption Academy school, and it was run by a nun, a Mother Superior, who was, her name was Mother Isabel Eugenie, and she had been trained in the Montessori method by Maria Montessori in Italy. And she used this educational method with Rosemary. And for the first time in Rosemary's life, she had an educational program that worked for her. It gave her success and a feeling of accomplishment. It was the happiest 2 years of Rosemary's life. The nuns were amazing with her. They had her teaching the preschool children in the school that she attended. She could read little books to them. They taught Rosemary math by having her count the china that had to be put out and then put away, or the pieces of silver, etc. And she felt so successful in everything that she did. But unfortunately, World War II arrived, and the family scurried back to the United States in the fall of 1939. But they decided to keep Rosemary there because she was so happy and the school was so successful for her. But by the spring of 1940, the Germans were marching across Europe and the writing was on the wall, so they decided it was too dangerous to leave her there. So they brought Rosemary home, and that was the beginning of the end of Rosemary's independent life, in a sense. She arrives back in the United States. Joe is still in London as the ambassador, but Rose does not want to deal with Rosemary. She is just has other things on her plate. So Rose, being deceitful once again, contacted the daughters of a judge who was a friend of her father's, and these two women ran a Catholic camp in Western Massachusetts. She approached them and asked them to hire her daughter Rosemary, who had been trained as a teacher and camp counselor, and they agreed to hire Rosemary. Well, they knew within about a week of Rosemary arriving in the summer of 1940 that Rosemary actually needed more counseling and attention than some of the young campers at their camp. After 3 weeks, they contact Rose and say, "This is not working out. You did not tell us what was going on with Rosemary. You need to come and get her." Rose said no, and she fled to Maine, where Elizabeth Arden had a spa. And these poor women were like, "You know, are you kidding?" They were so worried about Rosemary, they had to keep her in their cabin and put a dresser up against the door at night because Rosemary would get up in the middle of the night and wander through the woods and get lost. They were just at wit's end. Eventually, Joe had a secretary, Eddie Moore, who went and got Rosemary and brought her to Philadelphia, where there was another Assumption Academy school. This is in the fall of 1940, and over the next year, she is shifted from one school to the next, and her mental health is deteriorating rapidly, and they don't know what to do, and Rose is just washing her hands of her daughter. Joe Kennedy comes home in 1941, and they are desperate to figure out what to do with Rosemary. Now, with all that money, they could have hired two or three women to live with Rosemary, let her be an adult woman and go shopping and doing things, but they kept putting her in these Catholic convent schools. The last one that they enrolled her in, she would escape at night and wander the streets. They had no idea what was going on, but it was rumored that she was meeting men and drinking and heavens knows what. So her father investigated a brand new experimental procedure called the prefrontal lobotomy that was being done at George Washington University Hospital in Washington, D.C., where he was then living and working, and Rosemary was in a convent school there. Dr. Walter Freeman and Dr. James Watts were two men that were pioneering the research and the surgery in the United States at the time. When Joe met with them in the summer of 1941, they had performed about 60 to 80 of these operations. They were telling the press that the surgery was completely successful. In the May issue of the Saturday Evening Post, there was a big spread, a big article about their work, and they raved about their success, how they changed tormented people into happy, successful, independent people. But when I looked at their actual research, it was the exact opposite. Nearly none of their patients went on to live an independent life. Most had to be cared for by their families. Many of them did calm down if they had been more violent or, you know, uncontrollable. But a great majority became disabled. A quarter of them became completely disabled, and about 20% died. but they didn't report this to the press. The American Medical Association that summer warned against anyone doing the procedure. They felt that it was too soon and that people should not be experimented on. But there were no patient protections back in those days. And during that time period, a father, a husband, a brother, a son could force a woman in their life to undergo treatment. And this is what Joe did with Rosemary. He discussed it with Rose. I know a lot of people out there think that Rose had no idea what happened, but she did. He discussed it with her. She asked their daughter, Kick, who was a newspaper reporter at the time, to investigate it. Kick did so and came back to her mother and said, "Mom, this isn't what we want to do for Rosemary. You shouldn't do this." But Joe went ahead and did it. The surgery was a complete disaster. Rosemary came out of it unable to walk or talk or take care of herself. She was incontinent. She was a complete mess. She was sent to the Craig House in Beacon, New York for 7 years and then transferred to the St. Coletta School in Jefferson, Wisconsin, where she lived the rest of her life, and she died in 2005. Her siblings were not told what happened to Rosemary, although I think her two older brothers and Kick were aware, but there was no conversation. Senator Ted Kennedy wrote in his memoir that all he knew was that he'd better behave or he might disappear like Rosemary did. He was 9 years old when the operation happened. The operation took place just before Thanksgiving in 1941. Rose had a habit of writing round-robin letters to all the children. She would list all their names at the top of the letter, make copies, and send them to all of the children. The first letter after Thanksgiving, Rosemary's name is dropped from the heading of the letter, and she isn't mentioned again. She was completely dropped out of their lives. Jack saw her for the first time in 1958 when he was campaigning for the presidency, and he was transformed by it. Eunice took over Rosemary's care through monitoring her care at the convent school residential treatment facility at St. Coletta's in Wisconsin during the 1960s. And finally, in the 1970s, after Joe Kennedy had died, Rose began to bring Rosemary home for 2 visits a year, one time to Hyannisport and in Massachusetts, and one time to Palm Beach each year. At this moment, the younger generations got to know their aunt and learned to love her deeply. And I think that Rosemary had a great life at St. Coletta's, given what happened to her and what she was subjected to. Rosemary's legacy is what really is important here. By putting Rosemary at the center of the Kennedy family story, it now makes sense why the Kennedys did what they did. The children, they were deeply moved and affected by their siblings' struggles as a child, the rejection she felt, the treatment that she endured. And when they became involved in politics, they made sure that other people did not have to endure what Rosemary did. Eunice, of course, started the Special Olympics. Jack signed legislation before he was assassinated to establish research centers and community resources for people and families with disabilities. And Ted, of course, as senator, helped pass hundreds of pieces of legislation affecting the lives of people with disabilities, including the Americans with Disabilities Act. So these people were incredibly affected by their sister, and they acted on that. And that is why we need to be incredibly grateful for Rosemary's life. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Dr. Larson.